He told them the story of the girl from Bantry who came to the New World, and who brought her belief in Mad Sweeney the leprechaun with her. For hadn't she seen him of a night, down by the pool, and hadn't he smiled at her and called her by her own true name? She had become a refugee in the hold of a ship of people who had watched their potatoes turn to black sludge in the ground, who had watched friends and lovers die of hunger, who dreamed of a land of full stomachs. The girl from Bantry Bay dreamed specifically of a city where a girl would be able to earn enough to bring her family over to the New World. Many of the Irish coming into America thought of themselves as Catholics, even if they knew nothing of the catechism, even if all they knew of religion was the banshee, who came to wail at the walls of a house where death soon would be, and Saint Bride, who was once Bridget of the two sisters, each of the three was a Bridget, each was the same woman, and tales of Finn, of Oisin, Conan the Bald, even of the leprechauns, the little people. And was that not the biggest joke of the Irish, for the leprechauns in their day were the tallest of the mound folk? All this and more Mr. Ibis told them in the kitchen that night. His shadow on the wall was stretched and bird-like, and as the whiskey flowed, Shadow imagined it the head of a huge waterfowl, beak long and curved, and it was somewhere in the middle of the second glass that Mad Sweeney himself began to throw both details and irrelevancies into Ibis's narrative.
Such a girl she was, with breasts cream-colored and spackled with freckles, with the tips of them the rich reddish pink of the sunrise on a day when it'll be bucketing down before noon, but glorious again by supper.
And then Sweeney was trying, with both hands, to explain the history of the gods in Ireland, wave after wave of them as they came in from Gaul and from Spain, and from every damn place, each wave of them transforming the last gods into trolls and fairies and every damn creature, until Holy Mother Church herself arrived, and every god in Ireland was transformed into a fairy, or a saint, or a dead king without so much as a by your leave. Mr. Ibis polished his gold-rimmed spectacles and explained, enunciating even more clearly and precisely than usual, so Shadow knew he was drunk. His words and the sweat that beaded on his forehead in that chilly house were the only indications of this. With forefinger wagging, explained that he was an artist and that his tales should not be seen as literal constructs, but as imaginative recreations, truer than the truth. And Mad Sweeney said,
"I'll show you an imaginative recreation. My fist imaginatively recreating your fucking face, for starters."
And Mr. Jackal bared his teeth and growled at Sweeney, the growl of a huge dog who's not looking for a fight but can always finish one by ripping out your throat. And Sweeney took the message and sat down and poured himself another glass of whiskey.
"Have you remembered how I do my little coin trick?"
"I have not."
"If you can guess how I did it,"
said Mad Sweeney, his lips purple, his blue eyes beclouded,
"I'll tell you if you get warm."
"It's not a palm, is it?"
"It is not."
"Is it a gadget of some kind? Something up your sleeve or elsewhere that shoots the coins up for you to catch? Or a coin on a wire that swings in front of you and behind your hand?"
"It is not that, neither. More whiskey, anybody?"
"I read in a book about a way of doing the miser's dream with latex covering the palm of your hand, making a skin-colored pouch for the coins to hide behind."
"This is a sad wake for Great Sweeney, who flew like a bird across all of Ireland and ate watercress in his madness, to be dead and unmourned save for a bird, a dog, and an idiot. No, it is not a pouch."
"Well, that's pretty much it for ideas. I expect you just take them out of nowhere."
It was meant to be sarcasm, but then he saw the expression on Sweeney's face.
"You do. You do take them from nowhere."
"Well, not exactly nowhere. But now you're getting the idea. You take them from the hoard."
"The hoard,"
said Shadow, starting to remember.
"Yes."
"You just have to hold it in your mind, and it's yours to take from. The sun's treasure. It's there in those moments when the world makes a rainbow. It's there in the moment of eclipse and the moment of the storm."
And he showed Shadow how to do the thing. This time, Shadow got it. Shadow's head ached and pounded, and his tongue tasted and felt like flypaper. He squinted at the glare of the daylight. He had fallen asleep with his head on the kitchen table. He was fully dressed, although he had at some point taken off his black tie. He walked downstairs to the mortuary and was relieved but unsurprised to see that John Doe was still on the embalming table. Shadow pried the empty bottle of Jameson Gold from the corpse's rigor mortis fingers and threw it away. He could hear someone moving about in the house above. Mr. Wednesday was sitting at the kitchen table when Shadow went upstairs. He was eating leftover potato salad from a Tupperware container with a plastic spoon. He wore a dark gray suit, a white shirt, and a deep gray tie. The morning sun glittered on the silver tie pin in the shape of a tree. He smiled at Shadow when he saw him.
Ah, Shadow, my boy. Good to see you're up. I thought you were going to sleep forever.
Matt Sweeney's dead.
So I heard. A great pity. Of course, it will come to all of us in the end.
He tugged on an imaginary rope somewhere on the level of his ear and then jerked his neck to one side, tongue protruding, eyes bulging. As quick pantomimes went, it was disturbing. And then he let go of the rope and smiled his familiar grin.
Would you like some potato salad?
I would not.
Shadow darted a look around the kitchen and out into the hall.
Do you know where Ibis and Jackal are?
Indeed I do. They are burying Mrs. Lila Goodchild, something that they would probably have liked your help in doing, but I asked them not to wake you. You have a long drive ahead of you.
We're leaving?
Within the hour.
I should say goodbye.
Goodbyes are overrated. You'll see them again, I have no doubt, before this affair is done with.
For the first time since that first night, Shadow observed, the small brown cat was curled up in her basket. She opened her incurious amber eyes and watched him go. So Shadow left the house of the dead. Ice sheathed the winter-black bushes and trees as if they'd been insulated, made into dreams. The path was slippery. Wednesday led the way to Shadow's white Chevy Nova, parked out on the road. It had been recently cleaned, and the Wisconsin plates had been removed, replaced with Minnesota plates. Wednesday's luggage was already stacked in the back seat. Wednesday unlocked the car with keys that were duplicates of the ones Shadow had in his own pocket.
I'll drive,
said Wednesday.
It'll be at least an hour before you're good for anything.
They drove north, the Mississippi on their left, a wide silver stream beneath a gray sky. Shadow saw, perched on a leafless gray tree beside the road, a huge brown and white hawk, which stared down at them with mad eyes as they drove toward it, then took to the wing and rose in slow and powerful circles and, in moments, was out of sight. Shadow realized it had only been a temporary reprieve, his time in the house of the dead, and already it was beginning to feel like something that happened to somebody else a long time ago. Part 2. My Ainsel. Chapter 9. Not to mention mythic creatures in the rubble. Wendy Cope, A Policeman's Lot. As they drove out of Illinois late that evening, Shadow asked Wednesday his first question. He saw the Welcome to Wisconsin sign and said,
So who are the bunch that grabbed me in the parking lot? Mr. Wood and Mr. Stone. Who were they?
The lights of the car illuminated the winter landscape. Wednesday had announced that they were not to take freeways because he didn't know whose side the freeways were on, so Shadow was sticking to back roads. He didn't mind. He wasn't even sure that Wednesday was crazy. Wednesday grunted.
Just spooks, members of the opposition, black hats.
I think that they think that they're the white hats.
Of course they do. There's never been a true war that wasn't fought between two sets of people who were certain they were in the right. The really dangerous people believe that they are doing whatever they are doing solely and only because it is, without question, the right thing to do. And that is what makes them dangerous.
And you? Why are you doing what you're doing?
Because I want to.
And then he grinned.
So that's all right.
How did you all get away? Or did you all get away?
We did, although it was a close thing. If they'd not stopped to grab you, they might have taken the lot of us. It convinced several of the people who had been sitting on the fence that I might not be completely crazy.
So how did you get out?
I don't pay you to ask questions. I've told you before.